Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Kelvin.
I'm Joshua.
I'm Pat.
And this is Get Off My World. We're three guys and the occasional guests who like to talk about what we like and what we don't like quite so much about our favorite show, which is, of course, Growing Pains. No, sorry, it's Doctor Who.
You're not going to go for Manimal?
Manimal is up there.
Manimal is awesome.
And again, our guests are the wonderful Melissa Kircher and Wendy Bowlesby.
Can we have a Manimal podcast?
We could probably squeeze a couple episodes out of that.
Can we have a Manimal podcast that runs longer than the actual show Manimal?
What about Automan?
Automan. I remember Automan.
Anyway, hello, dear listeners.
Hello, this is Wendy.
And this is Melissa.
And we'd like to start off each episode with what we call temporal grace, where we like to talk about something we've encountered in the world of Doctor Who that made us happy recently. Who'd like to go first?
I'll go first.
Pat, go first.
I'm going to go out on a limb, as a matter of fact. I'm going to recommend a book for temporal grace that I have not actually read yet. But...
There are books in the universe you haven't read yet.
There's one or two. But the reason I'm picking it is because it's pertinent to a discussion we're going to have later in the episode. So I decided to talk about the book Reading Between Designs, Visual Imagery and the Generation of Meaning in the Avengers, The Prisoner, and Doctor Who.
Oh my God!
Holy crap, I need that book.
Written by Piers Britton and Simon J. Barker. Piers Britton is a professor at my alma mater, the University of Redlands, and Simon Barker is also connected with the university. Ooh. So it is what I just described. It's a semiotic view on The Avengers, The Prisoner, and Doctor Who. And I know that Britton worked in conjunction with one of the costume designers from Doctor Who, June Hudson, that's who it was.
And you know, Pat, I am leaving town, and I do need going away presents.
This is true. Perhaps we can discuss.
Yes.
So although I have not read this book myself, I have every intention of doing it, and so I think this is a valuable book, especially in light of what we're going to talk about later. And there you go, Wendy.
Oh, my God, yay!
Enjoy.
Wow. I am so happy right now. Okay, speaking of, this perfectly leads into my choice. I love that Doctor Who has become so popular that everybody is having fun with the TARDIS dress, right?
Yeah.
The everywhere you go, the TARDIS dress. Because it has led to what is possibly my greatest creation, which is my TARDIS jumper, which is my new favorite outfit to wear at Convergence because it has so many pockets. Every pane of the TARDIS on my jumper is a pocket, which means at any given time I have at least 16 pockets I can access to put different things in. It is truly larger on the inside. Thank you to Doctor Who fandom for giving me the idea.
That's great. Nice. I do recall you wearing the jumper and it was pretty awesome.
Jumping on the costuming thing,
mm-hmm.
Wow.
I, like every Doctor Who fan in the universe, watched the trailer for series 9.
Yep.
And we're recording these really early. By the time this sucker goes out, we've probably already seen one or two episodes of Series 9. But right now, all we have is this trailer. And this is going to sound a little negative. I'm gonna kind of sneak some negativity into temporal grace. But the frickin' hoodie. I don't understand how you can be a television professional and look at Peter Capaldi in that snappy white dress shirt and jacket and go, you know what this man needs? A f***ing hoodie.
Okay, where's the point where you get positive?
Well, no, hold on. I
just curious.
I mean, to me, this is like the you know, you've aired the first season of Jon Pertwee and someone goes, you know, take away his frilly dress shirts and give this man a dickie. I mean, to me, that's what we're talking about here.
Give this man a dickie.
Give this man
episode
a
title.
He needs to wear one of those t-shirts and say, I'm with stupid. It's like a hand pointing to me.
My positive thing is I recently saw some pictures put online from shooting in which Peter Capaldi is wearing a nice snappy white dress shirt. So,
oh, thank God.
This old curmudgeonly fan is very happy.
Another crisis averted.
Yes, so close.
Well, I was in England a couple months ago, and I had the supreme luck to go to the Globe Theater to see some Shakespeare. And it happened to be Merchant of Venice featuring Jonathan Pryce's Shylock.
Oh, my God.
I know, right?
We were just talking about
Jonathan Pryce, who played the master in Curse of Fatal Death. And it was his debut at the Globe, and his daughter, Phoebe Pryce, was playing Jessica, the daughter of Shylock. And of course, Jonathan Pryce was spectacular in the role, and, you know, he played Shylock as like a combination of victim and tyrant, you know, a victim of the prejudices against Jews, and as the tyrant he is in the story. But also, as a bonus, we got Michael Burtonshaw playing the Duke of Venice, and Michael Burtonshaw played Mr. Cole in The Next Doctor. Yeah, so it was, you know, since there were like only 50 working actors in Britain, you know, and they all share roles, you know, it was like inevitable there'd be some Doctor Who at the Globe when I went to see
this.
My
husband has a theory that there really are only 10 British actors, and 3 of them are, in fact, Hugh Grant.
And 7 more are Michael Caine.
My cocaine.
Dear listeners, if you ever need to say Michael Caine's name in the proper accent, just say my cocaine. My cocaine.
That's a useful tip. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, my bit here is going to require one of my characteristic long digressionary introductions.
To understand this, we have to go all the way back to the Civil War.
Not quite. I'm assuming you're familiar with a property called Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Naturally.
Well, no, but do go on.
Now, way back when Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles first came out as a black and white comic by Eastman and Laird, it had a backup feature that almost no one remembers called Fugitoid.
Good God, Kelvin.
Fugitoid.
Where are you going, Kelvin?
I'll let you know. Fugitoid was the story of like a sort of small, cute robot that has some kind of AI era where it becomes capable of independent thought and runs away. And apparently in this future society, robots that run away are called Fugitoids. And so it's this like little cute robot hiding from robot authorities trying to apprehend
it. Sad.
It's a kind of a sad thing. And the reason I bring this up is because apparently on Nickelodeon, there's going to be a Fugitoid cartoon. And the voice of the Fugitoid, David Tennant.
Way to bring it home, Kelvin.
Yes.
And I'm like, what in the hell? I saw this blog Doctor Who tweeted this.
That's one of the many
Doctor Who Twitter feeds I follow.
You know, this kind of doesn't surprise me because Kevin Eastman has more money than God.
He does.
It's true.
He owned Heavy Metal magazine for a while. He married Julie Strain.
He married Julie Strain, which I'm still upset about, yeah.
Because it was down to Kelvin and Eastman. She went with Eastman.
So now we're going to do a round that we like to call Special Topics Dalek. Wendy, I think you have a question for us this time around.
Well, what I would like to talk about briefly is the iconography of the costumes the different doctors wore and how they relate to the characters that they portrayed.
Elaborate.
Well, as it so happens, I have notes. No, seriously, I do. Sorry. Okay, let me just...
Yeah, it's a big comical scroll, listeners. She just unfurled it.
Brrr.
Like in the Happiness Patrol.
Okay, so we start with William Hartnell. Right? He's very Victorian looking, very uptight, except he's got that cowboy bow tie going on. Like, what is that about? And then somebody described him online as severity with eccentricity. And I really feel like that does embody what Hartnell was about. He was very uptight, right? He was very Victorian. He was very rigid, but he had this cowboy undercurrent that would come out. And so I really love that that is what the costume sort of shows you, right? Everything looks so laced up except for that weird string bow tie flopping around, showing you this man's gonna do something. Okay? Then there's Patrick Troughton. Oh, that unfortunate hair. But his dashing pocket square tells you there's more going on there. However, his ridiculous pants, are those Chaplin? Are those marks? And his bow tie is askew. What exactly is he trying to say there? I feel like even he doesn't know.
And then he's got the recorder. That's accessorizing, though.
Yes.
That's nice accessorizing.
Which leads us to the perhaps most dashing doctor of them all. Pertwee.
My man.
I wrote, dandy! Exclamation point. Superhero! Exclamation point. He is a lover and a fighter. That is the only thing that shirt tells you. That man can bring it all.
Ruffles.
Ruffles. With a cape.
Capes are important, really.
Yes. Now we come to, of course, a lot of people's favorite doctor, my doctor, the doctor I first encountered, which is Tom Baker, with his hat and his scarf. It's so iconic. It's casual. It's also a little incognito. He's trying to blend in, but he doesn't quite know how to do it. That scarf draws a little bit too much attention. But the scarf, it's so useful, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Then you come to Davison. What the hell is with the cricket? Is he Sporty Spice? On the other hand, it is perhaps my favorite of the Doctor Who costumes.
You know what? He wears it well.
It is.
That is a
flippin'
damn
stylish.
Yeah. He looks sharp in it.
It looks fantastic. I don't know about the celery, but I feel like incorporating vegetables is very open of him.
Well, he's a healthy eater.
Yeah, it's for the kids. Nutritional.
Celery for the kids.
Colin Baker, however.
Oh, God.
As I wrote in my notes, that poor, poor man, he has a personality disorder and it is reflected in what he is wearing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Seriously. I feel like for as much as everybody hates that costume is an accurate representation of what that man had to put up with as the doctor. Then there's McCoy. Why do I love McCoy? Because like Baker, he wears a hat. And it's a great hat and he knows how to wear it well. What does this say about these two men? They're confident, they're dapper, they have a sense of style and swagger that nobody else can match because it takes a real man to wear a hat. Also, his vest is rockin'. Question marks all the way. That's a man who knows how to carry a theme through his entire wardrobe, even to the umbrella. You want to talk about accessorizing? McCoy is your man.
I do love the umbrella.
Yeah, but also with, he's not only rocking a hat, he is rocking a boater hat. It is hard to rock.
He is like a more dapper version of Tom Baker's doctor.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the two of them share a certain spiritual connection there. It's all in the hat.
Like they're the same being.
Shh.
Okay.
Paul McGann, right? He is too pretty to be real.
Yeah.
And that is really all you need to say about that.
I admit, I was not paying attention to the clothes.
He is too pretty. His clothes reflect that. They are also too pretty to be real. What he is wearing, he's in the late 1980s, early 90s? When was it? 96, pardon me. And he's wearing velvet and tapestries, and it's just way too opulent. It shows
tapestries?
How... Well, his vest
is... called?
His vest is very brocade, right?
Oh, brocade, okay.
Yeah. And it shows how out of touch his doctor is, and he really is very disconnected from the humans that he meets. His costume really does reflect just the dichotomy of what's going on there. He was trying to be an American, and he did not know how.
Yeah, that's right. In the TV movie, it's supposed to be a Wild Bill Hickok costume.
Really?
I can't see Wild Bill Hickok in that outfit, exactly.
No. But
that's not what Keith Carradine wore in Deadwood, I'll tell you.
Nope. So now I'm going into the doctors that are only recently added to the canon, which is John Hurt.
Oh.
He's wearing leather. He's got the same sort of vaguely Victorian sort of opulence in that he's got this vest with an ascot sort of thing going on. And it's very steampunk with lots of gadgetry around. But his coat, and the coat is sort of a thing that's become a theme there, right? The long of duster coat is leather. Okay, so, this is saying something about this doctor. This is a doctor who's a little bit more gritty. He's wearing leather. But his collar is huge. Huge. Like villain-esque huge. So what does that tell us about this doctor? Is he actually a good guy or a bad guy? We don't know. That collar would indicate something else is going on.
Or perhaps just Time Lord, because they have the frill thing going on.
Yeah, no, seriously. His collar. Go look at his collar. Yeah. It's totally villain-esque. Which leads us then, who would be the next doctor is Eccleston, who wore a leather coat. I feel like leather denotes anger issues, yes. Mm-hmm. Anger issues, unresolved issues with how the world is treating you. Jeans and a t-shirt tell me that he doesn't have time to be bothered with what you think the doctor should wear. David Tennant, so many stripes. Right? This is a man who is moving all the time forward so fast. He can't slow down. He can't stop to think about his actions. Perhaps maybe he should once in a while. Maybe. Yeah. He wears glasses, which might make you think that he's going to stop and look at things, but he doesn't really.
But I would like to note about Tennant is that he's another one that wears his suit very well.
Yeah.
He suits his suit.
He does. He does wear that suit very well.
Yes.
It also makes him look incredibly thin, all those vertical stripes.
Yeah.
It's almost Tim Burton-esque.
And then we go to Smith. My least favorite costume.
Yeah?
It really is.
Even though it involves a fez.
I love the fez and I love the bow tie, but I feel like the rest of the costume is lazy.
Well, they're really kind of two costumes.
It's another case of the Doctor literally just stealing someone else's clothes that he found in a locker.
Except that we know that the clothes are chosen very specifically for the Doctor. Why do you say two different costumes?
Because toward the end, he gets more emo and he wears a long jacket.
Yeah, he wears like a vest and a
long jacket. Oh, that, when he's on that planet?
I like the professor, the combat boots, and the tweed jacket with arm patches and the bow tie.
There are things I really love about the costume. I love the bow tie. I actually love the combat boots with the sort of skinny jeans, professorial patches. I just feel like it's not clearly defined. Like they kind of wanted to say something, but they didn't want to commit to it, right? It gets a little too casual for me. It gets a little too young.
I know that originally, like the original costume concepts they were presenting to Matt Smith that he kind of vetoed. One was described as being almost like a pirate outfit.
Wow.
I'm glad it was like a long jacket and a ruffled shirt.
No, I feel like they were on the right track with their costume they chose. They didn't quite clarify it enough. Because it's still, the only thing that's really iconic is the bow and the fez. The bow tie and the fez. Everything else is sort of vague. But David Tennant, everybody's got a damn stripy suit now.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's very hipster. It's very geek-friendly.
Very hipster.
Mm-hmm.
Which now we have Capaldi. I love his costume.
Oh, yeah.
It's like a sleeker version of Pertwee's.
Yeah.
What about the Starfield sweater?
No. No. I'm going with the black suit with the jacket with the red lining. I love that red lining.
What's the white shirt?
The white, brilliantly white dress shirt that is buttoned all the way up. And no tie. No tie to clutter that. It is pure white under there. And I really think that says something about what they're trying to indicate about the Doctor. That pure white, that pure core, and yet that hint of red that flashes of passion and anger. I think it's a brilliant costume.
I'm sorry to bring this back to Temple Grace, but what is your opinion on the hoodie?
I'm with you on that one. I'm totally with you on that one. Why would you do that? Why would you cash down this doctor? This doctor is clearly got a personality, and what they're trying to do is just age him down. It's like they got an older actor, which I'm so for. I am so for an older actor again. And they're trying to like, oh, but he's still hip and cool. No, I don't need him to be hip and cool. I kind of like him just the way he is. And he rocks the hell out of that jacket.
I kind of see the 12th Doctor's costume almost as like a way of calling back the first Doctor almost.
Mm-hmm.
It really does, actually. Have you seen the side-by-side comparison of glamour shots of him and Pertwee?
Glamour shots.
They are in the exact same pose.
Mm.
it is, seriously, it's not coincidence.
Wow.
And when you see Pertwee with his white, ruffly shirt, black, with the cape with the red lining, and then you get Capaldi with his all-black suit with the jacket flaring with that red lining, and they're in the exact same pose, I feel like that's not a coincidence. I feel like they're deliberately trying to make that connection.
I do remember seeing some, like when the very first promo shot of Capaldi comes out with where he's doing the pose, they showed it to some costume designer woman who was not familiar with Doctor Who, and she like tore it apart. She was saying like the fit was super horrible.
She can suck it.
And I was like, it was like all this stuff that was like, God.
Who pissed in your Wheaties, woman?
Yeah.
Shut up and sit down.
Well, his pants do look sort of weirdly baggy when he's in that.
Well, they're going,
well, everyone's also, pants are baggy.
There's Kelvin just demonstrated.
They're putting
I don't know how to describe that verbally.
Not very great effect, but
that's
it was a great
radio,
try.
Kelvin. Great radio.
Yeah.
They put him in slim fit pants, which I don't understand. I feel like this is a doctor who would wear more classic trousers.
Mm-hmm.
So I ignore the pants and I just really focus.
The coat
on
is great.
How great the vest, the shirt, and the coat is.
Yeah.
However, I'm still going to point out he's not wearing a hat. You want my love? You want my affection, you put on a hat.
I don't think he could be improved by a hat.
No, this doctor isn't a hat-wearing doctor.
It's such a minimalist kind of
hair.
I love a lot about it. He's got great eyebrows.
Yes.
You really don't want a brim overshadowing those eyebrows.
Colin Baker outfit.
What I want is a doctor who's going to wear a hat like what Josh is wearing right now. That would be
Listeners, Josh is wearing a giant clown hat.
And now round three. The randomizer. But for today's episode, our randomizer is Melissa. Tell us what episode you've chosen.
I have chosen Shada.
What? That doesn't exist.
But yet it does.
Shada!
It does.
Everybody shut up.
Are we shadaing now?
Melissa? Come back, right. Shada.
Three, back. Two, one. Shada! Yes, it is the unfinished story of Shada, which was planned to go up and air in 1980, but halfway through production, a strike happened for the technical crew, I believe it was.
Something like
they
that.
Went on
yeah.
strike for a little while, and even though the strike ended at a time where they could have gone back and finished it, they just kind of went, eh, no.
Oh, that would be work.
Yeah. And but parts of it do exist. And back in the 90s, they, you know, a few folks went back and pieced together what did exist and tied the whatever was missing together with this completely crazy town narration by Tom Baker himself.
But Tom Baker is not the doctor. He's just narrating it.
Yeah.
He's also not Tom Baker, the actor, talking about his experiences filming it. He's just some random character in a museum telling the story about a person who just looks a lot like him.
In a Doctor Who museum,
I think
it should be pointed out.
The first canonical appearance of the curator.
It could be the curator.
Oh, yes.
That's my
Nicely done, Joshua.
Suddenly it makes more sense.
It really doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense.
So the curator didn't make sense.
And you picked this adventure specifically because?
You know, oh, God, why did you pick this? I am a big fan of Douglas Adams.
Who wrote this episode.
But also, this is actually one of my very early encounters with Doctor Who. Now, Kelvin, in the very first episode of this podcast, ruined my first introduction to Doctor Who's story.
I'm sorry, I didn't realize you were ever going to be
Well, thank you for your vote of confidence, Kelvin.
I didn't mean it like that. I just,
No, when I was a kid, Monty Python would air late at night on Sunday nights, and I'd sneak downstairs to watch it, but Doctor Who was on right before Monty Python, and therefore I would see the terrifying cliffhanger ending of Doctor Who first, which means I'd go hide behind the couch and wait for Monty Python to come on. And
I really want to picture this moment. But, how old were you?
Oh, I was about 7.
Okay, so let's picture a young 7-year-old girl sneaking down after hours. Everybody's in bed.
10:30 at night, Sunday nights.
Sunday
school
nights.
Night.
And parents in bed.
Parents in bed.
Sneaking down to turn on the television early. So turning on the television, knowing it's going to be terrifying, of click, run behind the couch.
Yep.
I think that's adorable.
Thank you, Wendy. But, you know, many years after, when I was junior in high school, senior in high school. Yeah, something like that. Seniorish in high school, I was dating a young gentleman named Andy who was a Doctor Who fan. And I hadn't been watching Doctor Who since my terrifying introduction to it. And he, first of all, introduced me to Douglas Adams, but also, since he was a Doctor Who fan, I bought him Shada when it came out on video cassette, because I went, oh, this is interesting. This is something that has not been available before, and he's never seen it. And, hey, Douglas Adams. And so I bought it for him, and we watched it, and I was completely confused.
I can't think why. Very
confused. And so after that, I also did not watch Doctor Who until much later in life.
So you chose this because
I have
chased you away from Doctor Who.
It chased me away from Doctor Who yet again. But I'm also very fascinated by unfinished projects. And I find this a weird, fascinating failure analysis. And also, being a fan of Douglas Adams's book, Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency, which is fantastic, that would not exist without Shada. Because since Shada did not get finished, he harvested Shada and made a novel out of it.
So in many ways, this is the most finished episode of Doctor Who ever, because it has shown up in Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. Uh-huh. They have novelized it. Gareth Roberts, Big Finish, made an audio version with the Eighth Doctor and Romana. It has been finished multiple times.
Ian Levine made a version of it that completed it. I even have a saddle-stitched Australian fan club version.
What the hell?
Of this over on the shelf. There was a period once Target had finished novelizing every single classic Doctor Who, except for a handful, specifically the ones that Douglas Adams still had the copyright on, and a few Terry Nation Dalek ones.
I think Eric Sabert a couple. They were the ones that he wrote, but it was probably due to Terry Nation issues.
Sounds right.
Yeah.
So there were five or six of these, and some Australian Doctor Who fan club took it upon themselves to novelize them in a Target style with Target style covers and offer them for free. So I have those over on the shelf. It completes the Target collection. One of them is Shada. Yeah, and now, of course, as Josh says, was it Gareth Roberts that did the... Okay. But a man I have a complicated relationship with, Gareth Roberts, is finished Shada. We're frenemies. He just doesn't know it. My personal favorite version of Shada, and here's another one that I didn't even mention before, Doctor Who magazine back in the day, when you would buy it, they would have a recap of a classic Doctor Who episode. They break it down, episode 1, 2, 3, and 4, and they would have a short recap of what it was, because this is back in the day when you couldn't actually see them on a regular basis. Some of them didn't exist or whatever, so this might be the first time you might see what the story of the 10th Planet or Tomb of the Cybermen was. But the issue on Shada was this super-sized thing, because they knew that literally no one had seen it.
Yeah.
And so it was a extremely detailed scene-by-scene breakdown of Shada that probably ran, I'm guessing here, 20 or 30 pages in several different columns. That was my first exposure to Shada, and it was brilliant. It's like, this is the most amazing thing I'd ever seen, because there are all these wonderful Douglas Adams-isms playing on the Doctor Who mythology. So there's Professor Chronotis. He's another Time Lord, and he's a doddering old guy, except he's not really.
And he's been a professor at Cambridge forever, and nobody is bothered. Nobody wants to point out that he's been there a long time, because it would be rude.
Which seems like a Douglas Adams joke until you realize that it's literally true, that he's really been there for hundreds of years, and that his room is a TARDIS.
Yeah.
And this is the first time that I remember them playing with the idea of a TARDIS, that it's not you can't tell it by the exterior. The exterior is not what's being disguised, it's the interior. Mm-hmm. And so when they come to open the door and the room isn't there anymore, it's just the time vortex on the other side.
Which, by the way, comes packaged with the worst double take ever in the history of entertainment. It's not even being done to the right camera. It's ridiculously bad.
But I find the character of Dr. Cronitis so delightful.
Oh, yes.
Oh, it is. The actor's great.
Oh, he's fantastic. So fantastic. He's so wonderful. He's so wonderfully the absent-minded professor of, oh, wait, by the way, I'm a Time Lord. Oh, wait, by the way, I took this book. Oh, wait, like, I have this book. Why do you have it? Because I kind of took it.
My favorite line in the entire story is when they're talking about the voices they hear from the sphere all whispering, mm-hmm. and they're trying to tell the professor about it, and he says, oh, it's undergraduates talking to one another. I'm trying to have it banned.
It's a great line.
Mark will be good, given how so many things fall flat on its face during this original production. Like that weird sugar line that they keep trying over and over.
Quit trying to make Streets Away happen. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, it is a weird mix of very creaky jokes with really authentic observation jokes like the undergraduate line.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Clearly he's pulling, Douglas Adams is pulling from his experience to write some of the jokes about the university, and then he's also trying to haul out some rickety old vaudeville jokes at the same time.
Yeah.
So what exists is mostly the location work, which they had finished first, and then the industrial action shut down their studio time. So the stuff that exists, it's actually quite nice. It's punting down the cam.
I'm going to be the person who talks about Skagra's costume.
Oh, here it comes.
God. That's the most fabulous thing in the history
of fabulous. Like velvet, velvet gold mine fabulous. Like, oh my God.
Space Cavalier with the full spangled hat.
Ziggy Stardust wishes he could rock that outfit half as well.
He has better thighs than Ziggy Stardust.
Oh, he does. And he, seriously,
and
the tight,
white.
The tight pants really work for him. Well, I mean, the tunic is covering the junk.
Well, right? Yeah.
Because you want to do that, because otherwise that's distracting.
It's a junk
really.
Tunic.
The kids will have weird feelings if they see that.
Well, it's just, that's never attractive. Let's be honest, gentlemen, the junk is not actually visually attractive. We put up with it.
Whoa, cutting that out of this podcast. I refuse to believe that.
I think it should be, you know, presented with, like, little pin spots.
Eat it, Joe's. Eat it, Joe's.
You know, and
boop, 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 boop.
The occasional insect dying against the neon.
When the guy drops his pants, there should be like a heraldic trumpets playing.
Anyway,
this is not. This is not about the full-on. Full-on naked man junk is a different category than the clad in white.
Listen, this we are man, working on the Naked Man podcast, so stay tuned because it's coming out.
Skagra.
Skankgra.
Seriously. Oh, yes. Seriously, Skagra is a great name for the outfit. Because it is so amazeballs. It is white, shiny satin that is skin tight, and this tunic, it is Buck Rogers in the fabulous century. And his shoulder pads go all the way out. He's got a cape, and the only way that cape works is if he puts on the hat. Oh my God, that hat makes the cape work extra hard. The two of them together, it's like peanut butter and chocolate, people. You can't have one without the other.
And the cape has like parts of the lining outside.
No, I mean, it's like it is stripy. It is particolored.
Yeah, it's like,
there's, wow. There's silver and white and silver and white and silver and white. And by the way, we just saw your fabulous double take to the wrong camera.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing.
Oh, and the guy playing Skagra works the hell out of that cape and hat combo.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and the hat and the tunic have random sparkles. Did we all notice the random sparkles?
There is a lot of City of Death-esque location shooting of him just strutting about Cambridge.
Just strutting about. And nobody noticing. That's the best part. Nobody stops and goes, what the actual hell is that guy wearing?
It's a college town. I mean.
Oh, yeah, that's really true.
That is gay-tabulous. I want that outfit desperately. Now that I have seen it, my life, there was a void that has now been filled.
So are you saying that you're a gay man inside of a straight woman's body?
That outfit turned me gay.
Okay, great. We'll just let that one sit for a while.
Apparently.
So, besides the terrifically gay nature of this, I have to mention Blake 7, which is happening at exactly the same time. Half of the sets are probably created for Doctor Who and then recycled by Blake 7, or vice versa, who knows. Skagra, as camp as he looks, would not be out of place in Blake 7.
Oh,
he would just be like, oh, it's just a person in the background with one of those giant hats. So this is the state of British televised science fiction in this period.
While we're commenting about costumes, I want to mention Chris's incredibly tight pants.
Of course you do.
But the,
seriously,
but the junk
so
is unattractive.
They are so tight. Like, they're way up his butt crack. They are just, like, defining every personal choice this man has ever made.
And that is why he is not as cool as Skagra.
It's true, because Skagra covers it up.
And it's
well fitted.
He's got
the junk cape. We've established
it's
that.
It's the mystery.
Yeah.
The mystery of the, like, the junk
cape. The junk apron. The junk apron.
Skagra has the deep V, which is so attractive on him.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, of a man of his build.
He rocks it. He wears it with authority and confidence. That is the only way you rock a cape and a hat combo like that. You've just got to wear the hell out of it.
So, let me recap. Do you like Skager's costume?
I love it so hard, Josh. Right. I do.
We should talk a little bit about the monster. The Krarg, is it? The 1960s plexiglass wandering Christmas trees?
Too many R's monster.
Krargs.
The pile of jagged edges.
Shingle monster.
Shingle monster.
And somehow it has some kind of energy absorptive ability.
If Chewbacca were the name of a villain,
it gives K-9 something to do, right?
Yes.
He like really does have to work at it. K-9 was always a problem, right? Because he's either too effective or they have to just sideline him completely. So they move him out in Power of Krull because he can't operate in the swamp, or they blow him up at the beginning of the Leisure Hive.
Leisure Hive, yes.
Yeah, because he goes into the ocean for some damn reason and electrocutes himself. But here, they sideline him as part of the plot. He has to control that monster.
We all hate K-9, right?
No, I'm sorry.
Oh,
I don't like K-9.
I love this hat, but I hate K-9. Get out of here.
K-9 is such a problem. He's such a problem.
Is he a narrative problem?
15 minutes to talk about a cape.
He is the scrappy do of the Doctor Who universe.
I'll agree with that.
K-9 is adorable.
He is not adorable.
No.
He is
no.
Hilarious.
No.
He is the Doctor's straight dog.
No,
he's the straight man of so many scenes.
He is not. No.
He's gold. He is the
Seppo
Marx of the TARDIS.
First off, he's silver. Second, he's scrappy flippin'-do.
We found a fundamental divide between the panelists here.
Thank you, Melissa, for being on my side.
I would just like to point out that we gave a K-9 to Michael Sheard himself, and he bashed it to pieces with his feet.
He did. He hated that dog.
Well, we all know, you know the good taste that Michael Sheard has expressed in all of his movie roles. And
that man played Hitler. If he wants to kill something, he's got a reason.
I feel that we're getting a little far afield.
I feel like this segment of the podcast is unfinished. We'll have to novelize it later. What do we think about this story?
Giant
here? Final thoughts.
Final
that
thoughts.
Might have something to do with Shada.
I would have loved more of Professor Crinitis in future episodes. That is a character that could have recurred for me.
I feel like the lady friend and Chris were kind of uninspiring as characters, but Crinitis and his TARDIS room and the whole Cambridge thing, as you know, kind of followed through on Dirk Gently's, I think is absolutely gold.
I agree with you that they're a little uninspired, but I like what Douglas Adams is attempting to do, which is split it into almost three different TARDIS crews, right?
Yeah.
You got the Doctor and his miss, but then you have Romana and Chris doing he's her companion, mm-hmm. and then you have Professor Chronotis and the lady,
Claire,
thank you, doing their own little adventure. So I like the ambition of that. It's like three different Time Lord and companion things swirling around.
Mm-hmm. And Claire has that reverse librarian effect where she's kind of attractive with her hair done up in a bun, and then she lets it down. In the classic librarian move, lets it down, and then she kind of looks like a man in drag once her hair is all down. Full.
Her makeup is beautifully time-specific.
Yeah.
Like 1980.
Right at the cusp of the day.
Disco right into 80s, right there.
Very the apple.
Very the apple.
Very the apple.
But the version of this I saw was the not Ian McShane.
The Ian McShane version.
Yeah, another.
But the
Ian Levine version.
The Ian Levine version that was reconstructed with animated bits and a guy imitating Tom Baker. It's just kind of interesting to see, like, at the end, when they finally get to Shada and it's the prison planet, and they look, the selection of aliens that the Time Lords have decided to lock up for eternity or whatever. You know, one Dalek.
That's one. The bad guy.
That guy. Like, that one guy.
Not the master.
Yeah.
Just a random Dalek.
Just one Dalek, like one Cyberman. Emperor Nero, apparently. there's like a Roman Emperor guy. And I think, and like a Zygon.
Oh my God, they're like the serial killers of their race. Like, they were so shy and quiet, and they seemed like nice people, but really, the Time Lords took them away.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
I will do a little plug for the big finished version. I like the geeky idea. From the five doctors, they used the footage from Shada. So Tom Baker was pulled out of the timeline, the fourth doctor, before he could finish this adventure. So in the big finish audio, it's the eighth doctor who realizes, crap, I never finished Shada. And he goes back and collects Romana and K-9 and goes and does the entire adventure of Shada. And it's very fun, very clever.
Crazy pants.
That is a very nice angle to go.
And I think I read it's only because Tom Baker refused to do it. And they were like, all right.
Look at
Paul McGann will do it.
Okay.
Paul McGann will do anything.
Yeah. And another plug that I'll make, you know, if you've never read Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency, it's a ton of fun. But even beyond that, the BBC in 2007 did a radio show adaptation of Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency with Billy Boyd as Richard and Andrew Sachs, who is Manuel from Fawlty Towers, as Chronotis. That was awesome. There was also a TV adaptation that I have not yet seen, but
you're making me want to reread Dirk Gently's.
You should.
I haven't read it in a while. I need to.
I like it. I've
never actually different ways to experience Shada. Mm-hmm. Just none of it on this podcast.
So you guys, this is our round four, our wonderful afunctionalism round.
Oh.
And I've just been feeling so warm, so, you know, exuberant and passionate, that I wrote a couple of poems.
Aww.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I hope you don't mind if I read them to you.
I would love that. Please
Thank
do.
Thank you. All right. So poem number one is called The Passionate Shepherd to His Ood.
I love you, Pat.
Come live with me and be my ood, and we will slavers all elude. A friend to ood I have been long. From silence now I shift to song. Of all your stately noble race, I dearly love thy tentacled face. My sphere and thine we shall conflate in harmony bountiful and great. For I doth find thee in thy lights more pleasant than the censorites. In manner thou art empathetic, and all of this for 50 credits. Pray heed my telepathic call, and with thy glowy plastic ball, and angry eyes of purest red, strikest other suitors dead. When bowered in our hive nirvana, thou shalt forget thy Dr. Donna. And even though thy face seem lewd, yet I shall be thy Sigma Ood. Thou sayest The circle must be broken, but the Ood in me thou hast awoken. If favor find with what I've wooed, then live with me and be my Ood.
Oh, that's the sweetest thing ever, in a really creepy sort of way.
So, but you guys, I have another poem that's a response to that one.
Oh my God, you have to read it. What? It's like you know your classical poetry.
This is called The Ood's Reply to the Shepherd.
Do you take milk and sugar? Have a nice day.
I think that's my best one yet.
Amazing. Pat, you are a master of words.
Oh, thank you. My Ood.
And now round five, the death zone. Now, we are placing two modern era companions into the death zone, and that is Clara and River Song. To the death.
This is a continuation of a discussion we had last time about women in Doctor Who in general. So, let's dial in.
Let's dig deep. Let's dive into this topic. Josh, I feel like you have some opinions on this.
They both really bore the pants off me.
So really, your answer is neither of them survive?
I really found River Song intriguing in the Silence in the Library two-parter. I felt like she was a character. I felt like she had some of the sauciness and the winkiness that we saw as her predominant and only character trait in the 11th Doctor era, plus some real character stuff. She was sort of, you felt her emotion at meeting the Doctor early in his lifespan, and it felt intriguing. And I felt like by the time we got to Matt Smith, she was kind of a caricature. And it was that thing that Moffat does where he takes a couple ticks, a couple of lines like sweetie and spoilers, and tries to make them into a complete character. And so I feel there's a lot of promise in River Song, but I don't know that we ever really realized that promise.
Well, the reason I brought up River Song versus Clara is I'm trying to figure out what the difference between the two characters is.
Oh, go deep.
Interesting.
Because honest to God, Clara is River Song continued. She is clever girl. She is smarter than the Doctor. She one-ups him. She manipulates him. And she makes sure that he always knows that she knows more than he does. And I kind of find it tiresome. Like, I enjoyed it with River Song to a certain point. It got a little tiring at the end. I enjoyed it with River Song, but they introduced Clara, and again, she was the impossible girl. And I'm like, we've done this before. We did this with Amy. We did this with River. We've had enough conundrums. Why does she have to be a mystery? Okay, now we finally solved the mystery, and the mystery is, oh, look, she's gone all throughout time to save the Doctor. Didn't we do this with Rose? Mm-hmm. Like, honest to God, what the hell is Clara other than everything that they've already done?
They're all one character. That's...
And it's Clara Oswin Oswald. Mm-hmm. Which is such a shame, because I think Jenna Coleman is very likable and very delightful. I feel like she would be really interesting as a more Sarah Jane type or Romana type of companion. And instead, they've just made her River Song light.
So I have some hope that she might be better next season. Because I agree completely with what you're saying. This last season, the first one with Peter Capaldi, I never felt like she was there for any particular reason except that she was a companion.
Like she's entropy. Oh, you were the companion my last incarnation had, so I guess I'm stuck with you.
Yeah, I don't even know if I know how to articulate it, but the whole thing seemed wrong from the beginning. The relationships didn't seem like they conformed. Now that they have one season under their belt, I'm like, oh, well, maybe.
Except that there's something going on. There's something wrong that it should take a whole season to get a Doctor and his companion to gel.
Well, that's totally true. There was a whole lot wrong with season 8. But was that the fault of Clara or just... So, well, let's dial back. What is the character of Clara? Because that's unclear to me.
Well, hell, I have no idea.
Clara was created to be a plot device.
Yeah.
I mean,
originally.
Yeah, she's not a character.
And so, like, when they kept her on past that, they sort of didn't know exactly what to do with
her. She was Moffat's soft mystery. Oh, look, we don't know what she is. Let us create intrigue around the fact that she keeps showing up, but we don't know why. Isn't that intriguing? And it is. It truly is. Except that what they decided to do with her had been done before.
Yeah, and it's a MacGuffin. She is a living MacGuffin, and there's nothing built around
once
that.
Once you shoot that bolt, what's left?
Yeah.
They claim that she's a control freak. They mention that, but I don't really see
No, there's nothing in previous incarnations of the character that demonstrate that.
So they built the relationship with Danny in this last season, and that's fine, but it didn't really go anywhere. It's the same kind of thing that we've seen before with people having to decide between the Doctor and their relationships. And she ended the entire season essentially by wrapping her arms around Danny the Cyberman and not really doing anything at all.
Which... kind of indicative.
So it's just kind of a pfift.
I'm very disappointed in Clara because I really like the actress. I really liked it when she showed up as the Dalek. I thought that was really intriguing.
Episode with her in it.
Yeah. And I feel like she's not that sort of sassy, quick talking character isn't the right companion for Capaldi's Doctor. It was the right companion for Matt Smith. She was cast apparently because she could talk faster than Matt Smith.
that was a thing I remember from the announcement.
They really liked her because she could talk faster than Matt Smith. She could keep up with him. Okay, that's fine. That's not Capaldi's Doctor.
No.
And she's not a good fit for Capaldi's Doctor. And they need to find...
The season was about how it's not a good fit. Yeah. And then they tried to tell us in the Christmas special that, oh, we changed our mind. It is a good fit. Everything's okay. And all the pre-press for season... 9 seems to suggest that they're going to go with this idea that they're having fun together now, and maybe that will change.
Maybe they can change, but they have to change
but
the
I
dynamic
feel, and
drastically.
I mentioned this in our previous episode, but I feel like there's a lot of tension with this idea of trying to make the companion the literal equal of the Doctor. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of, there's a problem there. I think to a certain extent there's this alien character. It's not about, they're stuck in this male-female idea. And so they want to make it equal. But really what it is this human on planet Earth and this guy who's lived
alien
forever
in
another planet and needs to kind of sort of show them the universe. And they can be their own complete character, but they don't need to be the equal. And that's where this sort of tension seems to be coming from, at least in Series 8.
I think what they should be going for is more of a Holmes and Watson sort of dynamic where they are... You know, one's an expert in this, but the other one has the soft skills that the other one does not possess.
Or the practical skills.
And, I mean, I felt like Tennant and Donna Noble had that sort of Holmes and Watson sort of relationship because the Donna Noble character had the empathy and so many other things that... Tennant's Doctor did not
compliment.
Have. Yeah.
Compliment.
They're complementary. They're not vying for the same character space.
Yeah.
Honestly, a human should not be able to compete with the Doctor. He's lived how long? He is an alien from an advanced race. There's no way a human should be able to keep up. And that should be okay, except that you've added on this male-female dichotomy. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's where the problem comes in. So you don't want a woman, a female character, to be the emotional touch point. That also is very problematic of, oh, look, the woman is the one who explains emotions to the man. That's barfy. Mm-hmm. But I feel like there is a Holmes-Watson dynamic that could be explored. Because it works so well with Tate and Tennant.
Yeah.
They could open up the TARDIS to more than one companion.
Yes,
too.
could we also have more... Like, I loved Amy and Rory together.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
And it was actually sort of fun when Mickey was traveling with Rose.
Those
and
were things
Eccleston.
We had never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And when we had Captain Jack as a sort of a random third companion. Why can't there be a third? Why couldn't... It's a party in the TARDIS. It's big, it's big enough in there for a party.
I want to see the TARDIS as like a tenement of interesting people. It'd be like Sesame Street in there.
Like, oh my God, like the young ones. And somebody just randomly like walks out from a back room. Yeah. It's like, who's that guy?
Hi,
Ian. Oh, he's been back there for a decade. I haven't seen him. What have you been up to? Dude, I only just found my way to the control room today.
Rick Mayall walks out in wearing just a towel and it all goes down.
I didn't know you had a second companion. I'd forgotten he was there.
I just want Harry Sullivan to somehow be way back there, like 80-year-old.
Oh, Ian Martyr. I love that.
You know what? Make me a writer for Doctor Who. Apparently, I have all the ideas. I'm just saying.
So we've dug into Clara a little bit. If that's a terrible expression, I'm sorry to have said it. Let's talk about River, and then let's
River did everything that Clara is doing better.
Yeah.
And that is partially a function that Alex Kingston is just... I'm sorry. She is so much more.
As a performer, she is wonderful to watch, I think.
Oh, I can't get enough of Alex Kingston. She shows up and I just want to watch her. She is having so much fun. Every frame she is in, you believe this woman, this is the life she wanted and she loves it.
Mm-hmm.
And she loves how crazy and weird it is. She is on board with it. And when you finally see the backstory of how she is Amy and Rory's daughter and blah, 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 weirdly, Alex Kingston makes it work. I'm not saying I like that, but Alex Kingston delivers a strong enough performance that I'm like, you know what? I guess I'm going to go with that.
It's like, I'll ride that ride, you know.
But Amy and Rory's last episode kind of hinges on Alex Kingston making it poignant. If you watch that episode, it's her that is actually the emotional crux point. She is where the lever is landing to like lift the world. I have a lot of problems plot-wise with her character and the ridiculous things that you're supposed to somehow overlook, and yet I don't care because I like River Song so much.
Okay.
Both actresses are dealing with material that isn't all the way there.
They need
to save it. I feel like, honestly, Clara has more material going for her than River Song. I feel like River Song has thinner material because she has such a convoluted plot and she only shows up kind of occasionally. So she doesn't have as much to work. I love the actress. I'm very much looking forward to the Big Finish audios with her, that they might be able to retcon some of this and add more character when she's the star.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they can put more focus on her.
She could be a star. She's so great.
Yeah,
she's so
fun.
Fascinating. And she's having such adventures that you're like, wait, how is she doing this now? I want to know the backstory on how she's hooked up with the Marines or something.
Oh yeah, well, in terms of New Who, she's another John Barrowman. She's a scene stealer. I mean, she walks
you
in.
You could
and,
do a whole spin-off of River Song, and I would watch that a lot.
And Big Finish is doing that. They just announced
I never really liked Torchwood. I didn't.
Nope.
Well, no, Torchwood.
But they're not in this. Yeah. But
we'll put multiple pins in that.
So many pins. Some pins they'll enjoy, some pins they won't.
My single biggest condemnation of Clara is I could not personally tell you what any of Clara's episodes are about. Like, I find them utterly forgettable.
The plot becomes about Clara showed up.
Yeah, and I find them so forgettable. At least with River Song, I remember some of the stuff that was going on there.
Well, yeah, The Time of Angels is great.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not saying the whole episode is great. I'm not going to claim that. But when the way she shows up by, like, the black box that's in a museum that she's carved her message on because she knows eventually the doctor will go there because that's how they keep score, that's so great.
Yeah, I can't go there with you with River Song. It always seemed like trying too hard. Like,
yeah,
this is Stephen Moffat like really trying to push, like, this is a powerful woman character written by a man who is just gonna do all of the powerful women tropes.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't defend Clara too much because I think she's sort of anemic, sort of floaty, but
there's not, it's not like
in the end, I think there's more long-term there. with her than with River, which I think was like fireworks that are just going to kind of...
River very quickly just kind of turned into a joke for me. Her, when she showed up, it was like, punchline, boom.
But are we dialing in, to steal a pat phrase, to the script, and you guys are really zeroing in on the performance?
It could be.
That's part of it as well.
Because honestly, the silence in the library, that... I loved her so much.
Yeah, I did too.
That every time she showed up after that, I was like, yay, it's River! She really was a game changer in terms of here for the first time was somebody from the in the doctor's life who had knowledge of things he hadn't experienced yet, which for a time traveler should be true.
Mm-hmm. Yet it's weird because the doctor seems far more obsessed with Clara during in both the 11th and 12th Doctor than he does with River Song. Who we're being told narratively is a more significant character to him, and he's supposed to love her. Yeah. And that's where it all falls apart to me. Well, but it also falls apart to me where how obsessed he is with Clara. So really, I think they're both losers in my book.
It falls apart when they try to tell me that River is his wife and that Matt Smith and River are supposed to be in love because I never get that.
You never feel that. It's
completely invisible.
Yeah.
There's like no chemistry. The two actors are fabulous in their own sound booths somewhere. They're fabulous. But like there is zero chemistry between those two.
So can we just vote that Donna Noble wins?
Yes.
She came out of the blue.
The dark horse came around that backstretch and won the whole thing.
Well, I'm willing to stipulate to that. But for purposes of the death zone, how about we take everything that we've just talked about and speculate a future season where Clara and River are both there? Who would we like more?
Oh, I think Capaldi and Riversong would be 10 times as fantastic as Matt Smith and Riversong together. I think there would be actual chemistry between those two.
Oh, I think those two would just have fun just outsmarting the hell out of each other.
Yeah, they would chew scenery together like nothing else.
Oh, God, yeah.
Could Clara step up her game to be better than season 8 with Capaldi?
Well, that's really setting the bar low, Pat.
I love Capaldi in season 8. I love him to death. And, you know, that this is hard for me to separate because that's the weakness of season 8 for me is just that he is so obsessed in a way that I can't really understand with Clara.
Right, so we have two votes. What we've seen and what we can think of seeing.
I'm vote for Riversong and the potential to her character, but based on what has been there, Clara.
What is Clara. What could be is River.
Yep.
Melissa?
I gotta vote River in both cases.
Yeah, I'm with Melissa.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Clara has not delivered anything of is. For me.
Yeah.
It's been a whole lot of smoke and mirrors with Clara of trying to make you think that something's happening and yet nothing actually has.
I think River has had higher highs than Clara has.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Kelvin.
I really don't know.
We love Kelvin in a position like this.
Yes, Kelvin, three metrics right now.
Go ahead. You can fret for like 5-10 more minutes. I'll just cut it out. <It's fine. laughs>
I don't know. Oh, crap.
Oh, God. I dropped the mic. Oh, God.
I dropped the mic. I always...
And you didn't drop the mic in, like, a final way.
So right
now... Is it still on?
Well, I think you're dealing... You know, both characters are kind of more gimmicks than characters, I think. And Clara was just so tied into that very first season she showed up in that, like, I couldn't figure out why she was around after that. And... River.
I think he's on our side.
River had no distinct.
He has a penis. He's born.
Oh, good God! So Clara had this like arc in that first season she was in. River had no distinct like beginning or end point, given that she's a time traveler in her relationship with the doctor. So it's like there was no real closure or anything. It was just kind of.
Just say it, man.
No, I think people are overly harsh on Clara, but I also
people,
don't.
You mean
but I also
Melissa
can't.
Windy?
But I also can't really call her a particular favorite of mine. She's
join us, Kelvin.
You will join us.
Podcast with us.
Okay, here's the thing. They're both very They're both fearless characters. That never gets brought up much with Clara.
I want an answer, Kelvin.
I don't know. I'm still trying to figure it out. I don't know how I feel about
this. Working it through, Josh. He's working it through.
I honestly don't know.
There are things to like about Clara. All of them first were originated in River.
And the other thing is...
Can we just agree that they're the same character and move on?
I'm also trying to, like, separate out the big, dumb male part of my brain because I do find Jenna Coleman almost ridiculously pretty.
Oh.
And I don't want to make it... I don't want that.
She is. Oh, my God, those dresses. Oh.
And I don't want that, like... Dumb
it's
hormonal
the dimples
thing.
That do it for me. But Alex,
Kelvin, should we just check
hair.
Back with you in another
the hair is pretty.
I honestly don't know. I honestly don't.
Kelvin,
they're both disappointing characters.
Kelvin, okay.
They're both disappointing.
Kelvin, you're the, benched. The you're
only,
benched.
The only clear answer is that the guests win out of politeness.
Yes, I
also,
think that's probably
we
it.
Had two votes for River essentially each.
But we had
because you guys were splitting your votes between.
Well, we had present day and potential, right? But you guys were a block vote.
Oh, fine.
We'll yeah.
All right, River wins this one.
Yay!
So,
I honestly don't know. Oh, we love you, Kelvin.
That brings us to the end of yet another wonderful episode of Get Off My World. I would like to very much thank our wonderful guests, Melissa Kircher and Wendy Bowlesby from the Xanadu Cinema Pleasure Dome. It was wonderful having their insights here today.
Thank you.
What are we doing next time?
It's a surprise.
It's a surprise?
Sweet.
Oh, my God. Like a birthday or something. So, anyway, until that day comes... I'm Kelvin.
I'm Joshua.
I'm Pat.
And I'm Melissa.
And Wendy.
And we're saying, get out of my world!
Is your audience somebody who knows Doctor Who as well as you, or somebody who does not know Doctor
Who? We don't have an audience.
Surprise!